Hey guys, welcome back to the Rose Report. This episode is the first part of a two-part series on immigration, and more specifically DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which the Supreme Court is set to rule on any day now. So just real quick, before we dive into content, I just want to highlight some ways you can connect with us to submit ideas or comments or really anything, even just to say hi. The first way is to add us on social media. So we have Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Rose Report. And the second way is to contact us via email. So we're our email is rosereportpod@gmail.com. Please do reach out to us. We want to engage with you. With that being said, as always, any content heard on The Rose Report is not to be taken as legal advice. Again, we are just here to inform and engage with you on the various legal aspects embedded in current events. So on today's episode, we have the chair of Rose Law Group's Immigration Department, Mr. Darius Amiri. Hey, Darius.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me.
So Darius has a really impressive background, and we'll definitely dive into that. But first, just some quick background on our topic for today, which is DACA. So any day now and up until the end of June, really, the Supreme Court could rule on DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So the DACA program is an Obama-era program that allows unauthorized immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children to live and work in the U.S. And before we dive into that, we're going to hear from Dan and Olin.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning back in. We are very excited to have Darius on the show today. As Wafa teed up, the Supreme Court DACA decision is set to be handed down any day now, and we're very fortunate to have Darius on to explain what that could mean, you know, what we might expect from that, and let's get right to it.
Yeah, hey, thanks for tuning in again, guys. We got a lot of awesome feedback from the people who listened to episode one. We hope to continue making this a better and more engaging and entertaining experience for you, the listener. And we are all very excited to have this first of two-part program, as this is a very relevant and topical thing going on right now and will have a huge impact on the country going forward. So this should be a pretty fun conversation we're going to get into here.
Great. Thanks, guys. So now we're going to dive into just a brief history of where DACA came from. So in 2001, the DREAM Act was introduced, which eventually led to DACA, which again, as I said before, is essentially Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That came about in 2012. Now, just a little bit about DACA. It has enabled almost 800,000 eligible young adults to work lawfully, attend school, and plan their lives without the threat of deportation. So DACA does not provide permanent legal status to individuals, and it must be renewed every 2 years. Now just for some quick stats on DACA. So on average, now these are national stats from AmericanProgress.org. On average, DACA recipients arrived into the United States in 1999 at the age of 7. So more than one third of these recipients, so that's about 37%, arrived before age 5. So given this and the many years that the DACA recipients have waited for Congress to come together and pass a solution that would put them on a pathway to citizenship, the average DACA recipient now, as in today, May 31st, is 28 years old. So that just kind of gives you a brief picture of who we're talking about. Definitely millennials here. So now I want to go into Arizona specific statistics, because as you know, the Rose Law Group, which we're all affiliated with, is located in Scottsdale, Arizona. So I just want to describe the characteristics of DACA recipients and their households as applied to Arizona as a state. So in Arizona, this is according to AmericanProgress.org, Arizona has currently 23,990 DACA recipients. Again, their average age in Arizona, 6 years old, average year of arrival, 1999. Now, the number of individuals living in households with DACA recipients in Arizona, we have 54,900. The number of U.S.-born children of DACA recipients in Arizona, 10,400. So now that you have like a really, you know, basic idea of the numbers associated with DACA, I want to introduce our guest of the show, Darius Amiri. Darius has handled thousands of immigration cases ranging from deportation defense, bond hearings and asylum proceedings to family petitions and employment and business-based immigration applications. Now, he's served clients from nationalities from all over the globe. His practice extends all over the state of Arizona, and he is licensed to appear in federal immigration courts across the country and in the U.S. District Court in Arizona. So with that, Darius, do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself, including, you know, what makes you so passionate about what you do?
Thanks, Waf. I appreciate the warm intro. I've been exclusively doing immigration law since I graduated law school, coming up on like over a decade, I think now. Background wise, my dad is an Iranian American. He came to the States on a student visa, met my mom. They got married. She's an American. And then he actually, as part of the deal for getting sent over here for school, he had to go back to Iran and do some military service in the 1970s. And so while he was doing that, the Iranian Revolution broke out. And he had to flee the country. And really, the only reason he was allowed back was because he was the spouse of an American citizen, my mom. And so I didn't really think about that too much, you know, growing up. I was very privileged. We grew up in Southern California, you know, had a nice little life and lived in the suburbs. But I always felt very comfortable around, you know, people from different backgrounds and different nationalities and who spoke different languages. And I think it was kind of like a natural segue for me into the practice of immigration law, just having that background. And there was really one instance where, at least recently, where I felt like everything kind of was clicking for me and was I was in the right place. And that was when the travel ban was handed down in 2017, right after Donald Trump was inaugurated. And if y'all don't remember, there was an executive order that said certain people from certain countries couldn't enter the United States. And so this happened kind of overnight, the rollout. And I found myself in California at the time, having started my own practice. And I just thought back to my dad and his situation and felt a lot of empathy for people who might be coming over now and who just find out mid-flight that they're not allowed in the country. So I went down to LAX and I was part of a group of legal representatives who helped people. It was a really cool experience. I felt like I made an impact and just felt like it reaffirmed my decision to practice immigration law. So that doesn't have a lot to do with our dreamers and DACA, but kind of just a little background about me and why I feel like I'm in the right area for me at least.
No, absolutely. Thank you for that. And you know, with this decision coming up any day now, this is a very relevant topic, and we're just really grateful that you can really outline just some basic details that our audience can hear before the decision comes down, so they have some knowledge ahead of the decision.
Thanks, Wafa. When we were first planning on having Darius on the show, I reached out to him. Kind of to discuss how we were going to go about, you know, talking about the issues that he felt were important in the immigration world, which clearly is the upcoming DACA decision. And one of my first questions to him was, what is your average daily type of workload? Because obviously me, the litigator, I'm facing off against somebody else, another attorney or another pro per. We're trying to argue over a dispute and I want to win. Whereas in Dan's world, as we kind of talked about last week, he's more working with another attorney who represents the, quote, other side, but they're working in tandem trying to draft the document or the set of documents to complete the transaction or enter into some binding agreement. And so I asked Darius, are you, you know, more like me where you're in court, you're drafting pleadings, trying to fight against somebody or, you know, argue against somebody? And who would that somebody be? Is it, you know, is it an entity? Is it the state? Is it the federal government? Or is it an actual individual who's maybe opposing an immigration application or something along those lines? Or are you more in the world of Dan where it's, you know, paperwork and making sure the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted and there's not really an objective other than working together to complete the task at hand? And I think part of the reason I had that question, and Darius will get into kind of the answer as well, is because in law school, there's not a class, at least that I took or that I know of that was offered, that directly talks about immigration. Immigration is kind of a unique subset of the law that you don't get exposed to unless you have a reason to or you have a passion for it. And I think that's part of what we're going to learn here from Darius and what his passion is how you get into that. Because I went into law school thinking I was going to do criminal defense. And I do a bit of that now, but the majority of my workload is civil litigation. And again, Dan did a little civil litigation when he came out of school, but now does mostly transactional work. And I was never exposed to immigration and I don't practice it now. And I think even, you know, attorneys who are seasoned and have been doing it for a while don't really know exactly what goes into that. So I'm excited to learn about that. I'm also excited to talk about this today because it's kind of a personally important to me. My family and I are all immigrants. We emigrated from the Ukraine in the late 90s and actually got our citizenship in 2004. My sister and I did. My parents got it a couple years before us. And so I'm interested to learn how the immigration process has changed or, you know, developed, improved, progressed, whatever it may be, since the 90s, early 2000s to today, because as Wafa pointed out, DACA didn't even exist until the early 2010s. So on that, I think Dan's going to give a little bit more background on DACA.
Thanks, Olin. And yeah, I think I have the same question that you teed up already, which is, you know, how different, you know, at least my interest, one of them here is how different is immigration law from transactional law and from litigation? How much does immigration take in those certain aspects of transactional or litigation? And we'll learn a lot about that today. So we're excited to have Darius explain that to us. So a little bit more about DACA. As far as eligibility goes, Wafa gave the brief overview of the program, but you can request DACA if you were under the age of 31 as of June 15th, 2012. So that really emphasizes the population that we're talking about here. I mean, Wafa gave some statistics about ages, but these are a much younger population than I think the general public would understand them to be. You also have to have come to the United States before you reach your 16th birthday. You have to have continuously resided in the U.S. since June 15th, 2007 up to present date. You have to be physically present in the U.S. in June of 2012 when you make your request, and at that time have no lawful status. And you also need to have been currently in school, graduated, or obtained a high school certificate or a GED or a veteran of the armed forces. And then there are some other carve-outs. You can't have been convicted of a crime, felony, or significant misdemeanor. So let's jump in and let's get Darius involved here because he's the real expert on this. And
we've been teasing Darius for 10 minutes now. Let's get him on here.
Well, thanks, guys. Dan, just listening to you go over the, you know, the requirements of what it took to qualify and apply for DACA when it first came out, it just kind of reminded me why this is a group of people that's so sympathetic and why you see, you know, bipartisan support for people who have DACA, where you don't normally see that in anything in America, much less in immigration. In fact, immigration is probably one of the most polarizing topics out there right now. But, you know, think about someone who is young, someone who went to school here, so they probably speak English, someone who doesn't have a criminal background, someone who wants to work, you know, and someone who wasn't necessarily brought here through, you know, or brought here through no fault of their own. So that's a very sympathetic class of people because these are people that you probably went to school with or worked with or played sports with. You identify with these people, you know them, or you know somebody who knows them indirectly. So you know, it's a group of people that we can all kind of relate to and feel for. And it's, you know, an area where I'm really passionate about, if you couldn't already tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
Darius, when you're talking about, you know, the requirements like Dan read and you kind of extrapolated on, it sounds like this was created because these people have the trajectory to be very positive, influential members in the workforce and on society. I mean, I think the fact that you had to either have been a veteran or obtain some sort of, you know, at least GED level education or currently pursuing higher levels of education speaks to the intent of what you're going to do with that or what you do once you, you know, graduate or finish your service.
That's right. That and there was another key point when Dan was reading the requirements, which was who didn't already have status or who was unauthorized at the time. So that also shows you that there was this large group of people that are, you know, the Obama administration had identified as people who needed a solution. So yeah, the education is a component, length of time in the United States is a component, clean record is a component, and then, you know, the fact that they don't have this authorization shows we needed to find a way to help these people. And that was what the DREAM Act had been trying to do from 2001 up until June of 2012, when the Obama administration finally used an executive order to make DACA. But that was the issue. Some people didn't like the fact that a president is using executive order to essentially make legislation, right? And I think that's kind of, we'll talk about the pending Supreme Court case, but that's one of the issues there, is whether that's a power that the executive office should be using. But the way I look at it, being an advocate, is that this, you know, this is a very sympathetic group of people that we want to help, who essentially, but for, you know, paperwork, or kind of are Americans already, that didn't have any solution. And so it was kind of a, okay, we've tried this for 15 years or 12 years, and now this is what we're going to do to try to help these people.
And I remember you mentioned in your little bio that you've been practicing immigration since you got out of school. And, you know, as I said, and I know Dan and I've talked about this, that, you know, we didn't have these immigration classes or this exposure to immigration. So how did you get exposed to it? Was it during law school, or was there classes in law school that you were able to take that kind of fueled this passion?
So I definitely had an interest in immigration, just given my background, and I did speak Spanish. And but it, you know, it wasn't like a core class that was taught. We did have an immigration clinic at ASU, but I didn't take it. I actually asked Career Services about immigration opportunities, and I think somebody told me that it was not going to be an area where I could make any money, so I shouldn't spend too much time on it. The way I got into it was I thought like you all, and that I was going to do criminal defense. And I worked at a firm that was primarily known for criminal defense, but they had a lot of you know, clients who had who may not have been U.S. citizens, who may have had immigrant backgrounds. And this was a time in 2012 where there was, again, we talked about the SB 1070 law, where there was a lot of people that were being put into immigration situations because of the consequences of behavior or criminal, you know, convictions. And so there was a natural segue, and there was a great opportunity for me to get involved that way. So I kind of was thrust into it, learned on the fly, and kind of haven't looked back since.
Awesome. So back to the other question I kind of posed at the onset here was, what is your day-to-day workload like? Are you more of a litigator? Are you more of a transactional attorney, or is it kind of unrelatable to either one?
So yeah, I think that in my practice area, I do general immigration, and there are different areas or subsets of immigration where people can become, you know, specialized or focused on. So there's, you know, immigration litigation, like removal proceedings, people who are trying to defend their right to stay in the country. And then there's more of a administrative side, like a family immigration, where you're filing petitions for spouses or relatives trying to bring them over here legally. And then there's business immigration, so employers filing for foreign nationals to come here on some kind of a temporary a visa or a work visa, or even ultimately a pathway to residency through a employer petition. So there's different areas of immigration. I enjoy immigration as a whole, and I tend to do all three of them. But I definitely would say that I got my start on the removal defense, consequences of criminal conduct for immigrants, trying to keep people from being deported.
And so in those events, you are actually opposing, I assume, the state?
Immigration is all federal law. So I would be opposing DHS, which is the Department of Homeland Security. And after 9/11, The INS, which people always will refer to as immigration, even today, but they reformed this department, and it's all falls under the swath of Department of Homeland Security. So there's ICE, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement. There's CBP, which is Customs and Border Protection. And then there's the EOIR, which is the Executive Office of Immigration Review, which is the Immigration Courts. And they all fall under the purview of DHS.
And do you happen to see kind of the same actors, in litigation? We kind of tend to see the same few names pop up here and there. And I know family law has their own subset. I know bankruptcy is an even smaller niche. Do you happen to see kind of the same attorneys on the other side, so you maybe can develop relationships with them and that helps your practice as well? Or is it, since it is federal, it's such a broad stroke that you don't know who's going to be showing up or who's going to be, responding or opposing your petition?
No, that's a good question. It is a small community. Immigration is a small community. And so we do see a lot of the same actors. And because I've been doing it for over a decade now, I've seen some people who started out as trial attorneys for DHS who are now immigration judges. So, I don't know how much it affects your ability to get good results, but definitely having familiarity with their thinking, their legal reasoning, their inclinations does tend to help you at least prepare for, strategizing for your court cases.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question I have before you really jump into the meat of the DACA is, talk about the difference between what my family, and I'll give a quick rundown of what I remember us going through. And actually, had a call with my mom earlier today to make sure my facts were right as I was, 10 years old, a young teenager through this process. But talk about the difference between the late 90s, 2000 and what you're seeing now. And obviously some of it won't be, your own personal experiences, but just from what you've gathered. So my parents, my dad got a H-1B employment visa in 1995 through the United States government. We actually moved to Kettering, Ohio, where he worked at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Through there, he got picked up by Allied Signal, which is now Honeywell. And so in 1997, we moved to Arizona, and both my parents got green cards. My mom got a green card to teach math as a professor over at Mesa Community College. And then I know they got their citizenship in 2002. So, as far as I understand, in 97, once they had green cards, then they applied for the citizenship process. And that took about 5 years. They got their citizenship. And 2 years later, my sister and I, were sworn in. I still remember going down to downtown, the offices there, and having a little flag pinned on my shirt and then going back to school, showing off my pin and bragging how now I'm a citizen. Another vivid memory I have, and I'm assuming it's still somewhat this way, but I remember when I was in fifth grade, so when my parents were applying for their citizenship, I remember helping my mom study for the citizenship test and running through the order of the presidents, because it was basically, an elementary school social studies exam that she had to pass, which obviously she did. But I just remember thinking it was kind of silly to me that, this is the stuff I'm learning and this is what you need to know to be a citizen here. So is that process still somewhat similar? And if so, in what ways? And if not, what's changed? I'm assuming, based on what I know, that process is probably longer and not nearly as flexible these days.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your story. And I imagine that was a pretty awesome feeling that day you got sworn in. That's one of my favorite experiences as an immigration attorney, is seeing a client go through the system and end up on the other side as a naturalized U.S. citizen, and seeing the pride at these oath swearing ceremonies that these people have in becoming Americans. It's really something that I think us natural born citizens definitely take for granted. And it's really awesome to see kind of how important it is for people who earn that right. So it's one of my favorite parts, parts of the practice. But I would say that the way it's changed is that, the fees have gone up, and the system is probably more adversarial today than it was, probably when you and your family went through the process. Part of that you could just chalk up to the Trump administration being less, friendly to immigrants as maybe some previous administrations.
Sure.
And in terms of how that relates to DACA and how it's different for these dreamers, these DACA kids, again, it's going back to when Dan and Waffle were explaining the requirements is that DACA was a solution that was created for people who didn't have any other alternative. So where Olin, your dad was able to get here on the H-1B visa, then he had an employer sponsor him, he got his green card, that route would not have been possible to someone who would qualify for DACA. And that was, I think, the impetus in the Obama administration using the executive order to create DACA, that we had to find some kind of a solution for this large group of people who were sympathetic, who didn't have any other alternatives. And that's what I think compelled them to create DACA out of executive order.
So had my dad or my mom failed to obtain an employer sponsored green card in 1997, would I have been qualified for DACA as of 2012 then, since I would have, you know, been under 31, I would have definitely come here before my 16th birthday. I would have resided continuously. You know, thankfully I have no felony or misdemeanor convictions. I have a GED and then some. So it sounds like because of the green card, I wouldn't have qualified. But had that not happened, I think I would be in a position where I would be awaiting this decision very eagerly.
Right. And that's a good way of you, again, assuming you're being honest about your criminal background, but
there's no background check to be on this podcast.
That's a way to empathize with these people in the same way I did when I saw what was going on at LAX with the Muslim ban, right? You know, but for a few different circumstances or twists of fate, you could be in the same shoes as one of these people, going through these horrors right now.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, I honestly did not make that connection until we literally were recording right now. And I started looking through these requirements and realized that short of my parents obtaining green cards, this would be me.
So let's talk about the case in front of the Supreme Court right now. Darius, if you can give like a we'll get into the possibilities of what could happen in a second. But as far as what question or questions the Supreme Court is being asked to answer right now, can you give us a 30,000 foot view of that?
Sure. So the question before the court right now is whether the Trump administration was permitted to end the DACA program, which it did so on in September of 2017. At that time, Jeff Sessions was the Attorney General, and they announced the end to the program. Through lawsuits and injunctions, DACA has survived to this point. But now the question before the court is whether the Trump administration had the authority to cancel the executive order issued by the Obama administration that created DACA.
Great. Okay, so now I think we're going to go ahead and segue into what are some scenarios of this Supreme Court decision that could come down any day now. So first, the first possible outcome is it's possible that the court could affirm the lower court's decisions, which would hand a narrow victory to the Dreamers. The second scenario is the court could hand the Trump administration a narrow victory. And the third scenario is the court could hand a crushing defeat to the DACA beneficiaries, holding that the DACA program itself is unlawful. Now, Darius, I just want you to kind of go over each of these in a really like brief way. What do you think is maybe most likely, maybe not going to happen? Just your basic opinion on these outcomes or anything that you think might happen.
Sure. So in the first scenario that you described, what could happen is the Supreme Court could say that the lower courts were correct in accepting the injunction to prevent the Trump administration from ending DACA through executive order. In layman's terms, essentially ruling that DACA is legal and that the Trump administration could not use its executive power to terminate the program. That would be a narrow victory for DACA recipients. One, because at this current moment, due to the nature of the injunction, there aren't new DACA applications being permitted. So someone can only renew a previously approved DACA application. Were this to be resolved in favor of the Dreamers, I would imagine that if the program is valid and legal, then it can resume as it was prior to September of 2017, and first-time applicants could be permitted again. So I think the reason why they're saying it's a narrow victory is because it still doesn't resolve anything long-term. It doesn't create a pathway to citizenship or a permanent residency, but it would at least allow the DACA program to go on. And in the form that it is now is a work authorization card that's issued in increments of 2 years. So, but for new legislation or new programs, at the very least, these Dreamers could continue to, you know, renew their work permits upon passing a background check and paying a fee every 2 years.
Does that go into perpetuity? You know, assuming that the narrow victory is the outcome here, can DACA continue to go, you know, well, pending any future legislation, you know, continue with that 2 year renewal forever?
Yeah, Dan, I would say it's exactly how you phrased it. Is, you know, I don't assume that this administration would just take a defeat like that laying down, right? So I would assume there'd be some kind of second version or, you know, refined version of an executive order. But assuming that the court says it's a valid program, yeah, it would go on uninterrupted until a more permanent solution would be offered, like legislation.
So what do you think is the most likely outcome? Just your personal opinion.
You know, unfortunately, the pessimist in me is preparing for the worst. And that would probably be a 5-4 decision down party lines, you know, ruling that the Trump administration, it's within their authority to terminate the DACA program in the same way that the Obama administration had the authority to create it. So I think as lawyers, we all have to, you know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. And so that's what we're preparing for. But there's another side of me that says, you know, and I take this from experience with the travel ban, where the first two versions of the travel ban were stricken down in court. It was only upheld upon a third issuance with a more narrow and refined definition. And what that tells me is that the court is going to do its job and, you know, analyze the legality of the program in the first place, and also the Trump administration's, you know, attempt to take it down. And what I also hope is that since the court did uphold the travel ban, I would hope that they would take that same reasoning to say that if the Trump administration is allowed to confine or to restrict immigration through executive order, that then the Obama administration had the right to create solutions through executive order. And any other reading of that would just be so political that it would, I think, undermine the credibility of the Supreme Court.
Do you think the swing vote's going to be Roberts?
After this recent California court case, if you guys are familiar, there was litigation about whether Governor Newsom in California could restrict church congregations under, you know, the guise, or not under guise, but because of concerns related to COVID-19. And Roberts ended up, this was just this week, but Roberts ended up siding with the other four liberal justices. So kind of, I guess, I don't know if I would call Roberts the new Kennedy, but I think of the five conservative justices, I think Roberts probably is the most likely to rule in areas that might benefit the other side. I think we saw that with Obamacare too, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's why I pitched it that way. I thought that's my, you know, personal impression and hope, is that the swing goes that way.
So what happens if this is a, you know, if the pessimist in you comes to a T here and the court rules that the DACA program is it essentially that the DACA program was unlawful from the get-go? Is that what the Trump administration is seeking here?
So I think the court's decision would, it could even avoid calling the program unconstitutional or illegal, but I think they could just uphold the Trump administration's authority to end mm-hmm. the program on executive order without getting into whether DACA was illegal or constitutional.
Yeah, they would punt on that issue, right?
Right.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I would think. And assuming that happens and they just defer to the executive power to terminate the program, then the question is what happens next, right? And so the Supreme Court isn't going to come out, I don't think, and say you have to turn in your work permits tomorrow. They're not going to outline consequences. But I think the administration then, with a win, can come back and say, okay, here are the terms moving forward. And the big fear is, well, so the immediate consequence that we're worried about is you know, the loss of these work permits, because you know, there are somewhere close to 700,000 DACA recipients who are currently, you know, active DACA status working with these work permits right now. That could be a huge blow to the economy if they're suddenly taken out of the workforce. Then the secondary fear, which is just as big of a fear, but maybe not as immediate, would be, would these people then be subject to deportation? Because DACA is, I mean, just in its own, in a reading of the language of the program, deferred action against deportation. And so it's you know, and to qualify for the program, these people had to submit biometrics, you know, fingerprints. They had to give their email addresses, their phone numbers, their physical addresses. And so, you know, and I remember back in 2012 when this, when DACA came out, that was a concern among clients. Like, hey, I've lived in the shadows all these years. And on one hand, I don't like it. On the other hand, I'm not worried about someone knocking down my door because they don't know where I am. I'm going to give this information to this, to the government. What happens when Obama's not the president anymore? And that's literally, I remember the person's face who asked me that question as this is all happening now, because that's exactly, his fear has exactly come to fruition.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because my question, as you were saying all that, was going to be, how much, if any, is the fact that there could be a regime change, you know, effectively 7 months from now, how much does that play into the potential decision? I know it doesn't impact the actual decision, but practically, you know, the Supreme Court's not going to change come January of next year, but the regime could. And how does that change, I guess, more of procedurally what could happen based on either a narrow victory or a narrow loss to the Dreamers?
It's a great question. So I would say, If Trump does not win, and Biden does, that we see the continuation of DACA at a bare minimum, or an expansion into something that would ultimately be a pathway to residency for these people.
Regardless of this decision?
Well, I guess it would depend on how the decision comes down. If the program is deemed unconstitutional, then whatever Biden does would have to take that into account, whatever, and if they're going to try to use executive order again. If it's a clear cut, you cannot use executive order to create immigration, you know, what otherwise would be legislation, then the onus would be on our Congress to get together and figure out, you know, how we can create legislation that's going to help these people.
Do you ever see a bipartisan resolution to these questions, or do you feel like it's going to be a, you know, something we revisit over and over depending on who has control, who's in charge, and how the Supreme Court is looking?
So we were very close to passing the DREAM Act, the legislation version of the DREAM Act, not DACA, a few times. McCain, who was a Republican, was a champion of the bill. I think at one point even Lindsey Graham was in favor of the DREAM Act. So things change. You know, our country wasn't as polarized politically 10 years ago maybe as it is now. So I'm hopeful that we could, because like I mentioned at the beginning, you know, DACA, the DACA recipients, Dreamers, these are people that we empathize with and we relate to, and there is bipartisan support for them. And I think that, you know, if you can translate that into pressure on politicians to get together and come up with a solution, then there is hope for that. That being said, yes, you know, the realist in me knows that anything across party lines is very rare these days.
Well, and I guess the follow-up to that is, what happens if my math is correct in 2028? Because I feel like DACA is not applicable to anyone at that point. If my math is correct, I feel like it will need some sort of either legislation to just end the question, or, you know, I guess then a new executive order, assuming the executive order route is deemed constitutional, will need to come down. Or do you anticipate between now and that date, there will be some sort of finality on the question?
I do. I think that the executive order was really just a stopgap. It was never intended to do anything more than offer a temporary solution for these young people who were left in the shadows and who needed a way to come forward and work and buy property and contribute and pay taxes. But it never, you know, DACA never offered a pathway to citizenship, because I think the Obama administration realized the limitation on executive power. So I think ultimately we, you know, just no one who has DACA will look you in the eye and tell you they're happy with just a 2-year work permit. They take it over deportation, but they want to be citizens. They want to have green cards. They want to be able to leave the country and come back. They want to be able to petition family members. You know, they want to be able to vote. So DACA was never, you know, DACA was a band. It was always a band-aid. And so my real hope is that we keep the program alive, at least temporarily, because I don't expect anything better than DACA from the Trump administration. But moving forward, we got to all get together and figure out a way to help these people with long-term solution.
Yeah, well, and absolutely. As you said, this is a really, you know, you've said this a couple of times, this is a sympathetic group, and it's a group that has been, you know, I can't say this, you know, with a total blanket statement, but it's a group that's been contributing to our society and our community, particularly here in Arizona, as we have such a big immigrant population. I mean, these people they're on the front lines right now. A great majority of them are maybe not a majority, but a good portion of them are healthcare workers. They're food service workers. They're out there working right now during the stay at home and the quarantine. And they are, you know, valued members of our society. So, I mean, my sincere hope that I think I probably share with everyone here is that there would never be a situation where we ask these people or force them who have, you know, to leave the country because this is truly just treated as a deferred deportation program. I really just hope that that's not where we end.
And jumping on that, has there been any study or any guess by experts as to the financial impact that would, you know, forcing these people, these 700,000 to leave or to, you know, end their contributions? Do we have any way to quantify what the impact would be, you know, at a community level, but also at a national level?
Yeah. So when the DACA decision first went to the Supreme Court, there was an opportunity for a lot of organizations, pro-immigrant organizations, pro-dream organizations, to file amicus briefs in support of DACA. And so there was a lot of information submitted at that time with favorable statistics. I remember reading something like $4 billion between state and federal taxes are collected as the result of Dreamers and their contributions. I know that you mentioned essential workers. I think almost a third of DACA recipients, current active DACA recipients, are deemed essential workers. So, you know, the people who are on the front lines in our nation's response to COVID that we couldn't, you know, really function without. And I believe that there's something between 30 and 60,000 of DACA recipients who are currently in healthcare in one shape or another. So, I think there would be an immeasurable impact, negative impact on our local and national economy if you took these people out of it.
And has there been any, I guess, on the other side, discussion as to how we would supplement that or to help with the issues caused by taking these people out? Or is that kind of a, you know, we'll approach it once we get there kind of question?
You know, I don't spend much of my time on the other side of it because I'm an advocate for DACA. I know that, you know, there are groups that are anti-immigrant, anti-DACA that will come up with statistics about how, you know, they're displacing American workers or, you know, things along those lines. But I have a very hard time looking at the DACA program as anything but an absolute net positive.
So another question I have is we've talked about, you know, we're expecting a decision any week now. The decision could be any time. What gives us that impression and what is, you know, is there a drop dead date when we have to have a decision or how does that play out? How long could these dreamers, you know, be in suspense?
So most legal scholars have been anticipating a decision on this case before the court resolves its docket, which is usually at the end of June or the, you know, beginning of July traditionally. And so that's why people think that the DACA decision is looming right around the corner. That being said, there doesn't have to be a decision. And in fact, I'm an advocate for there not being a decision or at least a delayed decision, given just what a negative DACA decision would do to our society and our economy at a time where there's a lot of unemployment and socioeconomic upheaval and protests and rioting and fear over a pandemic. So, and there actually is some precedent for that. So, in 1918, the Supreme Court postponed arguments due to concerns about the Spanish flu. And again, in 1793 and 98, they shortened their calendar because of concerns about yellow fever. So there is precedent for it, and typically it has only been in extreme cases like a pandemic, which is exactly what COVID-19 is. So I would be an advocate for, you know, kicking this one down the road rather than getting a negative decision right now.
I think what we find with the Supreme Court too is there are a lot of, at least my sense is, there are a lot of rules of thumb or rules based on historical precedents, but there's relatively little actual rules on the books that require the justices to act and conform in a certain way. Would that be accurate?
I believe so. And if you've seen how we've relied on norms for a lot of things, we've bucked those trends with this current administration. I'll give you an example, tax returns, right? So that was something that all candidates would traditionally disclose. Didn't happen this time. And I think, norms and conventions versus hardline rules, there's an argument for maybe if it's not a hard set rule, taking context and timeliness and some of these into the decision to rule now or to defer. And I would hope that, you know, these judges do tend to live in a bubble and they have lifetime appointments and they're very smart people, but they may not be, living a day-to-day life like you or I, but I would hope that they'd be able to see what's going on in society and take that into some consideration in deciding whether to rule right now.
Just to play devil's advocate, though, you mentioned 1918, they, postponed oral argument. All the briefing, all the oral arguments, all the facts are in front of the judges, right? So we are literally just waiting for them to hand down a decision. So, if we were hoping for a postponed decision, some of the factors that the precedent has had in favor of postponing aren't present here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it would just be more of a rational decision to look at what the effect of a negative decision would be on, our socioeconomic fabric right now, as there is a lot of, tension and angst.
Right.
Presently.
And, I guess we'll never know how much of the human element ever goes into a judge's decision, whether it be the Supreme Court or when I'm in downtown Justice Court here in Phoenix. So, that's always a factor you want to consider, but, at the end of the day, I think you want the law and the facts to be on your side more so than the rationale of the human mind.
Certainly.
All right. So I just want to backtrack a little bit and talk about COVID-19 and its sort of relationship to DACA, if there is one. And Darius, you can shed light on that. So as we know, there has been a lot of concern about COVID-19 spreading in detention centers, things like that. Now, if there is some sort of actual decision on DACA that, say there are deportations and stuff, COVID-19 is something that's going to have to be taken into consideration. So in your opinion, Darius, do you think that COVID-19 will sway the decision in any way? And if so, how?
I don't know. We had just kind of talked about what factors, behind closed doors might be considered if there's a decision to, defer the issuance of an opinion here or not. So we don't know. I would hope that, the judges do take a real world approach to this, but they're judges, they're lifetime appointments, they're scholars, and how much of that is going to happen, I don't know. I would say that taking 700,000+ people out of our workforce, a lot of whom are essential workers and are health workers, healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, physicians. I think that would only exacerbate some of the pressures our economy is already feeling due to COVID-19. I'd also would say, if dreamers are denied the right to work or even worse, placed in the deportation proceedings, you'd have a confluence of a lot of people being put into immigration detention centers or having to go to immigration court. And we've seen, the more packed people are into these spaces, the more likely there is to be, you know, the passing of the virus. So I do think there could be a lot of negative ancillary effects with a negative DACA decision, given what's going on with our country right now and the spread of COVID.
All right. Well, I think that pretty much covers everything we want to talk about for this episode. Lots to be discussed as soon as the Supreme Court actually decides, or maybe they don't decide. But on our part two, we will definitely go into more details on that. Darius, thank you so much for joining us today. Honestly, the information was very, very helpful, and we hope that our listeners will be able to have a better picture of what's really going on.
Thank you so much for having me, you guys. And I think, if I'm able to come on and give some information, I know it's a personal topic and it can be a polarizing topic, but I think the more people understand about the DACA and the Dreamers and their plight, the more sympathy there is to be gained. These are people that are really part of the fabric of our society, and they deserve all the empathy and support that we can give them.
Well, if we don't hear from you, you know, we don't know when we'll hear from you next. We might hear from you sometime in June or July, or it could be a lot longer. If we don't hear from you for a while, it's your opportunity to plug anything you want.
So absolutely. Yeah. I represent a lot of Dreamers. It's an issue very near and dear to my heart, and I'm happy to talk about, you know, this decision or any kind of, you know, other concerns for anybody at any time. So feel free to email me at Darius@roselawgroup.com. And we've also just developed and unleashed a website that's going to address this decision, rights, information, media for Dreamers. It's called DACAlawyers.com. We're really proud of that. And if anyone wants to go and check that out, that's DACAlawyers.com.
Thanks, Darius. Yeah, for coming on and sharing that fantastic information. If the listeners do have questions or comments or topics that they want Darius to touch on the next time he comes on, please do reach out to us, as Wafa indicated earlier, via social media or email.
Yes, please connect with us. We have Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can add us at The Rose Report on Facebook and Twitter. On Instagram, we're The Rose Report Pod. And also our email, rosereportpod@gmail.com. All right. Thank you so much, guys. Make sure to tune into the next episode happening in a few weeks. And again, engage with us. We want to hear from you. Thanks again.